This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Aaron Gritzmaker. Today is September 29, 2008. Both Mr. Gritzmaker and I are in the interview room in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech University. How are you today, sir?
Excellent.
All right. Why don't we begin, if you don't mind, if you could just tell me a little bit of biographical information, when and where you were born.
I was born in Enid, Oklahoma on the 19th of August, 1942.
Okay.
I moved to Oklahoma City when I was about 2 years old, and from Oklahoma City we moved to Clovis, New Mexico in 1950.
Okay.
And the rest of my life I spent in Clovis and Roswell, New Mexico.
All right.
I graduated from school at Roswell High School.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were their names and what did they do for a living?
My dad's name was Jack Gritzmaker, and he was a commission buyer for sheep and hogs, and my mom was a housewife.
Okay. Do you have any siblings?
I have two brothers.
Okay. All right. Would you mind give me a little bit of a description of your childhood? What was it like growing up for you?
Well, we grew up, particularly around Clovis and Roswell, was almost like being, it wasn't that far off the frontier. And I've got a brother that's a year younger than I am, we had a great childhood growing up out there, hunting and hiking around in the mountains and stuff like that.
Okay. All right. Did you have any jobs as a young man?
Yeah, I was a janitor and off and on, and I delivered oil well logs for a while, and that's about all I can think of off the top of my head in Roswell.
All right.
Worked a lot of construction also.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. What about high school? Could you tell me a little bit about it? What was your favorite subject and that type of thing?
Oh, my favorite subject has always been history.
Okay. All right. When did you graduate from high school?
In 1960.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Actually, I was supposed to graduate in 60, graduated in 61.
Okay. All right. When you graduated from high school, was there an expectation that you would go to college or get out?
Yeah, I went to New Mexico State in Las Cruces for a year, and I went to the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque for 2 years.
Okay. All right. What did you major in?
Nothing.
Okay. All right. Now, this was, when you entered college, this was 1962.
61.
Okay. How aware of you as to what was going on in the world with the Cold War, and had you kept up with it at all? Did you?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Anything in particular that comes to mind that you remember quite clearly as a child?
Oh, yeah, I think really the one thing I do remember, and because I was in college in Albuquerque at the time, was the Cuban crisis,
mm-hmm.
you know, where JFK
mm-hmm.
had the blockade going on in Cuba.
Right.
And also the Bay of Pigs, and I knew a little bit about what was going on in Laos at the time, because JFK was backing some people in Laos at that time, and he ended up kind of double-crossing them and selling them out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which led us directly into Vietnam.
Right. Did you have any relatives, uncles, or anything that had served in the military before you?
Yeah, my uncle was with the 45th Division during World War II, which was the Oklahoma, Texas National Guard Division.
Okay.
He was at Anzio, Salerno, all through Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
They were the Thunderbirds.
Right. Okay. Did he ever tell you anything about his experiences?
Very little.
Okay.
He won the Silver Star, and I don't even know why he won it. I mean, you know.
Right.
He was wounded at Anzio, I believe.
Okay. All right. Well, that's your interest in history, and the fact that you had an uncle who served in World War II, did that have any effect on you and your decision or your desire to go into the military?
No, not really.
Okay. All right. Well, what did make you decide to join?
I was very, very bored in college.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't doing worth a damn. I spent more time at work. At that time, I was selling men's clothes for a department store in Albuquerque.
Okay.
And I was about to flunk out, so that I would have gotten drafted. So I originally went in to be a helicopter pilot, but I had two cavities at that time in my teeth, and I was absolutely broke.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't take me without having those cavities fixed for the helicopter course. So I just joined and figured I'd get them fixed in the Army, and then I'd go to helicopter school.
Right. Okay. And what made you kind of get away from that?
During basic training, we had a guy by the name of Jimmy Easter
mm-hmm.
come and talk to us. He was a E-7 or E-8, real little guy, probably weighed 120 pounds, and he was in Special Forces. He was a recruiter for Special Forces. And I think there were like six of us in my basic training company qualified to take the test, and this guy really looked cool. And I had by that time read a little bit about Special Forces and had known about Roger Donilon. He won the Medal of Honor at a place called Nam Dong in I Corps, which I ended up near several times.
Okay. All right. Well, where did you go to basic?
Fort Buck, Louisiana.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about your basic training? Just a little description of day-to-day?
Yeah, it was just, you know, pretty boring. Basic training is geared to the lowest common denominator. So it's very boring and very slow.
Okay. All right. How did you adjust to the military lifestyle?
No problem.
No problem. Okay. And could you tell me a little about the instructors? What were your thoughts on them? And
they were okay.
Okay. Were they mostly veterans?
No, I don't think most of them had been to Vietnam at that time.
Okay, and too early for Vietnam.
Yeah. And there may have been a few Korean War guys, but very few.
Okay. All right. Well, did you find this early training to be sufficient for what it was supposed to be?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Did you have any memorable moments? You mentioned the Special Forces guy coming in. Were there any other memorable moments that stick out from basic?
No.
Okay. All right. You mentioned taking a test to get into Special
right.
Forces. Could you tell me a little bit about that test?
Okay. They gave it to us on a Saturday morning, and it was done on a tape recorder at normal conversational speed, and it lasted about 3 hours, and it was a situational awareness test.
Okay.
And they would just ask questions and give you a multiple choice answer.
Okay.
And you picked it. And the only one I remember is that you were a cab driver, and a fare has offered you a $100 tip to get him to the airport on time. You can go by the main, what the answers were, you can go by the main road, but you won't have time to make it. The second one was you can go by the main road and speed, but there are occasionally radar traps.
Mm-hmm.
You can know about a back road, but the last time you heard anything about it, the bridge was out, or you could refuse the fare. And I don't know what the right answer is.
Okay. All right.
But that's the kind of questions they asked. Mm-hmm. Some of them had absolutely nothing to do with the military.
Mm-hmm.
It was just how you would... It was a critical decisions test. And they just wanted you to make decisions.
Right.
And then we went through several mental tests and some physical stuff. And
Okay. All right.
Special Forces wasn't real strong on physical stuff, believe it or not.
Okay.
They figured if you were mentally up to doing it, you could push your way through physically most of the time, if you were a normal person.
Right. How many people took this initial test?
I think there were like six of us from my company and probably some from the other companies, but I don't actually remember.
Mm-hmm. And you said how many people passed?
To the best of my knowledge, two of us passed.
Okay, so two of us said, okay. All right. When the Special Forces recruiter came out, what did he tell you in particular what he was looking for? I mean,
I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But he was this guy was the coolest looking guy you've ever seen. He walked in, he's wearing a green beret, he's got starch fatigues on, shine boots,
mm-hmm.
Vietnam veteran. So he was really a cool guy. I mean, you know, he'd sit down and talk to you like a real person rather than mm-hmm. yelling at you.
Right.
It was a you know, really cool deal. And that, which, you know, after that, even at that time, it had become known as an elite unit.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So I was very impressed with him.
Okay. Well, did he, when you were talking with him, did he talk anything about, did he mention Vietnam? Did he talk about his experience?
Yeah, he probably did, but I don't really remember.
Okay. All right. So this was during the middle of basic that this happened?
Correct.
Okay.
1964. July of 64.
Okay. All right. So after passing the test, what happened next?
After I got out of basic, I went to a month-long NCO course. At that time, after I passed that, I went to advanced infantry training,
okay.
Training on all the different weapons and stuff, which was a great time. Man, I had a good time in AIT.
Okay.
Because we shot a lot of different weapons, and then from there I went to jump school.
All right. Where did you go to the NCO school at?
At Fort Polk.
It was also at Fort Polk.
Right.
What about AIT?
Fort Polk.
Okay. All right. You talk about the different weapons training. Could you tell me, like, what kind of weapons you were training with?
All the light infantry weapons, M60 machine gun, M14 rifle, 45 pistol, the 3.5 rocket launchers, M79 grenade launcher, 50 caliber machine gun.
Okay.
Just the basic infantry weapons, you know.
Okay. All right. And
no M16 training at all.
Right. Okay. How long did the training at AIT last?
It was 8 weeks.
It was 8 weeks, okay. Right. All right. And what other types of training did you have besides weapon training?
We had basic communications, some very basic first aid. General military discipline. Geneva Convention rules, UCMJ.
Okay.
Just kind of a broad spectrum, but primarily weapons, you know. And a lot of map reading.
Okay. All right. What about the instructors here? Were they veterans, or do you
know? I do not know.
Okay.
I don't much think so.
All right. Did you find this training to be pretty good?
Excellent, yeah.
All right. Okay, and from there you went to jump school?
Right.
Is that right? Okay. And where was jump school?
Fort Benning, Georgia.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about the training at jump school?
Well, it lasts 3 weeks. The first week is, I think, called the ground course, and you just practice parachute landing, basically. The second week is tower week, and you jump out of the 34-foot towers onto a to a probably 100-foot cable, mm-hmm. and slide down, practice landing, practice exit of the aircraft, and then the third week is a jump week.
Okay. How many jumps did you have to make?
Five.
Okay. Was there any apprehension? Did you have any apprehension? Or
no, by that time they've got you so ready to go, mm-hmm. that I never saw anybody not jump.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So did anyone fail during this time? Was there any?
Yeah, there were a lot of guys drop out of jump school.
Okay.
You ran every place. You had to be in really good physical condition.
Mm-hmm.
You had to be able to do so many chin-ups and so many sit-ups. All kinds of stuff like that. I've got some pictures of jump school someplace.
Okay. Now, what types of planes were you jumping out of?
C-130s.
C-130s, okay. All right. And how long did the jump school training last?
3 weeks.
3 weeks, okay. So after 3 weeks, they had you ready to go, jump out of a plane, no
right.
problem. All right. What about the instructors here? Were these combat veterans, parachutists, or...
I doubt if they were combat veterans, but they were all
okay.
parachutists. They were excellent. I mean, you know, they knew their jobs.
All right.
They wore black hats, and that's what they were called.
Right. Okay. Were there any particularly memorable moments that stand out in your mind from jump school?
No.
All right. Okay. So where did you go from there?
Okay, from there they took us to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to the Special Forces Training Group.
All right. Could you tell me a little bit about that training?
Okay, the training, Special Forces is, again, mainly mental.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
and we started off with a course called, it was... public speaking is what it amounted to, and given instruction in methods of instruction, MOI is what it was called.
Okay.
And it lasted 2 weeks, and you basically got up and speaking before a group, using an interpreter, using two interpreters, and these guys were Vietnam guys.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew what was going on, and but it was just a learning how to give instructions to other people.
Okay. And when you're working with an interpreter, that's for how would that be different than just getting up there and speaking?
Well, because you've got to still. People have a tendency when they're talking, when they're going through an interpreter, mm-hmm. to speak to the interpreter rather than speaking to the group.
Okay.
And you don't even want to look at your interpreter. And you also want to know, you want to trust what he's telling the other guys, you know,
mm-hmm.
that he's actually interpreting your words right.
Right.
And in Vietnam, the interpreters ran from very good to the majority of them weren't very good.
Mm-hmm. Now, how could you tell if they're not translating correctly?
Because the guys aren't doing what you've asked
well,
them
yeah,
to do.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Or what you've advised them to do.
Sure.
Because we were advisors.
Right. Okay. Well, did you find this training to be pretty good?
Excellent.
All right. Okay. What were the... Now, when you're practicing and preparing in this methods of instruction training, were the interpreters did they actually interpret in another language or was
no they did it in English?
Okay,
and then you were right.
Okay, all right. And then from where did you go from there?
Okay, then from there I was in Special Forces, you're in and out of training a lot. Mm-hmm. So you have what they call 0 weeks, where you do ash and trash and KP and stuff around the post. Mm-hmm. So then I was off for a couple of weeks. Then I went to Fort Sam Houston because I qualified to be a Special Forces medic.
Okay.
And I went to Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, and I was there for about 24 weeks.
Mm-hmm. All right. And did you originally want to be a medic?
No, I wanted to be a demo man. Okay. Demolitions.
Right.
But there weren't many people qualified to be medics. It was the highest level you could go without, you know, and they just didn't have enough of them, and you automatically make rank a little faster as a medic and some things like that. So, yeah, that's the reason I switched.
Okay. Well, what you talked about, the highest level you could go with, what type of, what did they base that on, your performance and prior training, or?
The test.
Just, oh, okay, that was the test you had.
No, that was the test we originally took.
Oh, that test you took in basic.
Yeah, okay. The test we originally took and some more tests we took at Fort Polk, which were mainly psychological tests, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, could you tell me a little bit about the basic medical training?
Basic medic training lasted 8 weeks, and you learned to be your basic combat medic on with an infantry platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just putting on field dressings, sterile fields, stretcher, how to set stretchers up, working in hospitals. Mm-hmm. It's your basic corpsman. From there, we went on to 16 more weeks of advanced training that was taught to us by either doctors or medical officers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all our instructors by this time were officers.
Okay.
And they were either doctors or medical administrative type people. And we learned different diseases and stuff like that.
Okay.
I'll show you. This is the only curriculum I'd say from our courses, mm-hmm. but that was
okay.
Just learning all different types of diseases and
right.
And how it affects the body and how to diagnose it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Was the training focused at all on Southeast Asian diseases or just diseases in
general? No, diseases in general.
Okay. All right. Let's see. And how would you, this may be too broad of a question, but how would they teach you about diagnosing a disease? How would you go about doing that?
Well, you would learn it, you know, in classroom, and then you know, then we practice giving each other, and then you're just, you know, just like a doctor would.
Sure. Okay.
And we gave each other shots. We intubated each other. We catheterized each other. Because what Special Forces is set up to give guerrillas instruction.
Mm-hmm.
And to work behind enemy lines is how it was originally set up.
Right.
So you could conceivably have a casualty under your care for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, we were taught a lot of learned how to pull teas, learned how to deliver children, long-term health care,
mm-hmm.
plus the first aid we'd already learned was, you know, reiterated all through this. And what we did start looking at Vietnam in particular for hydration,
mm-hmm.
Parasites, malaria, And so we all, by that time, we were all starting to look at Vietnam.
Okay.
And during the 16 advanced weeks is when the Marines first landed in Da Nang, and we were all really disappointed that they beat our class in, you know.
Right. Okay. You mentioned working in hospitals, like, are these all military hospitals?
Right.
Okay. Could you tell me what...
Okay, after I graduated from the advanced medic course, I went to Fort Rucker, Alabama, and I worked there OJT for 8 weeks, and we rotated through different different departments in the hospital, from the surgical ward, the emergency ward, the lab, general nursing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what else, but that's what we did. We worked in there for 8 weeks.
Okay. How did you do with all these different rotations?
Well, I passed.
Yeah.
Right. They didn't really ever give you any grades. I mean, you know, you either made it or you didn't make it. I mean.
Okay. All right. And did you feel that this training was pretty good? And
excellent.
Okay. So you felt confident after this that you could be...
With what's coming up. Yeah.
Right. Okay. One thing I wanted to ask you about the advanced medical training. Was this the dog lab?
The dog lab.
Okay, yeah. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
I'll show you some pictures of the dog lab I've got someplace.
Okay. All right.
What we did is we each got a dog.
Mm-hmm.
They had dogs from all over the Carolinas,
mm-hmm.
stray dogs, and we would take that dog, and he became our patient.
Right.
And you got to know, you tried to learn everything you could possibly learn about that dog.
Mm-hmm.
And at the about 3 weeks into it. And this course was taught all by Army surgeons.
Mm-hmm.
And about 3 weeks into it, you would take this dog. Well, the first thing you did was you cauterized his vocal cords. Because there might be as many as 50 or 60 dogs in there
right.
at a time. Because they were running four classes.
Mm-hmm.
And you cauterized his vocal cords so he couldn't bark. And then from that time on, he was your patient,
mm-hmm.
and so then you took him in and you shot him through the back of the leg with a M14. You did a radical debridement on him and left the wound open and just kept him from dying, you know.
Right.
And for trying to keep the infection out.
Mm-hmm.
Because on a radical, when a bullet passes through, the faster it goes through tissue, the more tissue on either side all around it that it destroys.
Okay.
And that tissue's got to be removed. It's called radical debridement, or it'll turn gangrenous.
Right.
So you operate on this dog, and then you're responsible for him for the next month.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, you work as the anesthetist, the main surgeon, the scrub tech, secondary surgeon, for other guys working on their dogs.
Okay.
And you're all together, you know, trying to keep your dogs alive.
Right.
At the end of 3 weeks, you bring him back in, the doctors look at him, see how he's doing. This is all supposed to be done without drugs,
mm-hmm.
without any antibiotics.
Okay.
And just good surgical and nursing techniques.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of that time, if your dog hadn't died, you put him, you amputate one of his front legs so you know how to do an amputation, mm-hmm. and then you put him down.
Okay. All right. So was it difficult to keep the dogs alive?
Yeah, because you got 50 dogs in a pen that are, you know, peeing on each other.
Sure.
And feces around all the time, and mm-hmm. you know. So yeah, infection was very easy to have. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got to take him back in, debride the wound again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And each time you do that, it gets...
Right.
He's got less of a chance because he's getting weaker on you.
Mm-hmm.
So, but again, that was so we could, if we were stuck behind enemy lines for any length of time and had someone that was hurt, we could take care of them.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You mentioned the dog being your patient. Were you supposed to treat the dog more like a human being or look at it just as a dog?
Well, I think we just looked at them as dogs, but I mean, you know, they were our patient. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were expected to, if a doctor asked us what our dog's average temperature was,
mm-hmm.
they expected us to be able to do it just like that.
Right. Okay. All right. And did you think this prepared you for pretty well for, say, combat surgery? And
oh, sure.
Okay. You said these were all, at this point, it was all doctors and nurses training you?
No nurses, all doctors.
All doctors, okay. All right. And at this point, were people still washing out of the program?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of people washed out of dog lab.
Mm-hmm.
Let me find a... Just to give you an example of... These guys with X's are guys that locked out.
Okay.
So you can see there were maybe out of the original group of, I don't know, 50 guys, you know, 30 of them flunked
yeah,
out.
It's like quite a bit of them, yeah. What was the most difficult aspect of it?
Well, you were tested, and plus you were... Throughout this training, you were given tests, and you either passed it or you flunked it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you flunked too many of the tests, you were out.
Mm-hmm. So no second chance?
Yeah, they would bring them. By this time, they were starting to get really short on medics in Vietnam, so they started recycling people at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some guys that I ended up with in Vietnam and that I had known that were recycled, and they were really good guys, but it just... You know, it took them a little longer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well,
this was a very difficult course.
Mm-hmm. And this was only for Special Forces medics?
This only Special Forces medics.
Okay.
The other thing about Special Forces medics, Special Forces medics are the only medics in the world that are listed as combatants.
Okay.
So we were shooters first, medics second. I was a platoon leader in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get to that later.
Right. Okay. So in this case, then, the Geneva rules about medics didn't apply in this case. Then.
That's correct. We were listed with the Geneva Convention as combatants.
As combatants. Okay. All right.
Now, that's what I've always been told. I don't know that for... I've never read it myself.
Mm-hmm. Right. So all this training, that also prepare you for, and this is getting ahead, but MedCap operations, did you... participate in some of those?
Oh, yeah, a bunch.
Okay. All right. Well, that's something right. We'll discuss later on then. But, where did you go from here?
Okay. Then I was out of training for about a month, pulling KP and ash and trash and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. Then on the first of the year, we went into what's called the FTX, field training exercise. And it's 8 weeks, basically 8 weeks of living in the field, and you jump in and you, they call it Robin Sage now, but it used to just be called the FTX, and there's guys on the ground that are, that meet you, and you become their advisors. They're a guerrilla group. You advise them, and this is in the Fiske National Forest in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Then you advise them and how to you've learned how to, during the FTX, during the classroom phases, you learn how to do dead drops and live drops and various intelligence stuff, and then how to advise a guerrilla group, and as a medic, I trained some of these guys so they could be field medics and get the people back to me to work on. And the combo guys and the demo guys all did the same thing. Weapons people were training these guerrillas. And it was really good. I mean, and at some point in time, they would get mad at you because you weren't doing what they wanted you to do or something, and revolt on you and act like they were all going to leave or something, and you had to negotiate with them to keep them from running off on you.
Right.
And which actually turned out to be the case several times in Vietnam that I know of.
Okay. All right. Well, was this training also at Bragg?
Was it what?
Was it also at Bragg, at Fort Bragg?
Yeah, no, it was at Fort Bragg, yeah.
Okay.
In North Carolina.
Right.
Yeah, from Fort Rucker, my OJT at Fort Rucker, and then Dog Lab, then the FTX.
Right, sorry, yeah. Okay. All right, and how long was this training again?
It was 8 weeks.
8 weeks.
And it was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. All right. Can you take me through just a typical day from morning to night of that training? Could you?
Well, like you'd be in the classroom training is, of course, obvious, but you'd be out in the. We parachuted in to the Pisgah National Forest and met these guys, and then it was just a day-to-day of training the guerrillas, setting up ambushes, keeping our AO clear of guys. I know one time I was hiding up really high up, and I was probably 30 feet up in a big pine tree. Mm-hmm. And one of the instructors came through and wanted me to, and I challenged him when he came in. And he said, okay, you can show yourself now. And I never would show myself. And he got mad. He says, God damn it, I told you to come down there. I said, no, I'm not. You know, he never did find me.
Right.
So he finally ended up leaving.
Okay. Then were there, like...
And these guys, again, had been to Vietnam. Some of them were with the White Star guys in Laos, which was Bull Simon's group in Laos. Some of them were the original guys from Europe. Quite a cross-section of instructors that were all excellent.
Okay.
And they were mainly the NCOs with a few officers mixed in. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, was this training geared specifically for Vietnam, or
no,
was it more broad-based?
It was broad-based for wherever you were going to be sent, because we had guys in Panama at the 8th Special Forces Group. We had guys in Africa. We had guys going out on Gem 9 missions. They went, and that's something that you might be interested in. Is they went out on Gem 9 missions on the Gem 9 spacecraft.
Right.
And they would sit in hotels all over the world for months on end, in case this capsule came down in the wrong place, and they were set up to go in and pick these guys up.
Okay. All right.
So it was a broad-based training type deal, not just Vietnam. Vietnam had not... I mean, we were the only people over there for a long time. And then after the Marines came in 65, and it started expanding from there. But.
Okay. Let's see. During this the field training, was there also, you talked about being up in the pine tree and challenging the officer there. Was this like combat, like situations, like I guess what I'm trying to get at is, did you have like field exercises where it's competitions between units, like combat situations?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. And how did your unit usually do with those?
Okay, I guess,
All right.
I don't really remember having any major problems. I know our combo guys had to make contact all the time with them. And they had to send code at something like 80 words a minute or something, which is really very fast.
Mm-hmm.
And our demolitions guys They were actually engineers because they could build. They built schools in Vietnam, and they also blew stuff up. And you know, and our weapons guy. It was just a like an A team was in the field training guerrillas.
Okay.
And that's the way it's still done to this day.
Mm-hmm. All right. Was there any other particularly memorable moments that stand out?
It was a good time. Mm-hmm. You know.
Okay.
It was like a big hunting trip.
Right. All right. So this training you would say also very, very good or?
Excellent. Okay. Yeah. All the special forces training was very good.
Mm-hmm. All right. And after this, were you a Green Beret?
Or? That's correct.
Okay.
Then I graduated.
All right. And how did you feel about officially becoming a Green Beret at this point?
Oh, I was quite proud of that.
Yeah. Sure.
Sure. I had just gone through over a year's worth of training to reach this goal, mm-hmm. you know. Right. So, yeah, I was very happy with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Looking back on it, which was what part of the training was probably the most difficult?
Oh, dog lab.
The dog lab.
Yeah, without a doubt. It was actually called, it wasn't called dog, that was the student's name. It was actually called Advanced Medical Laboratory, I believe, in Fort Bragg.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
So, I mean, it was difficult. They gave us hard tests, plus you had your dog to take care of. I mean, we were up 16 to 18 hours a day doing this stuff. Plus getting up in the middle of the night if something happened to your dog.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. After graduating, becoming a Green Beret, what next? Did you get your orders to Vietnam at that time?
No, I went to the 7th Special Forces Group. And they put me in the dispensary for the 7th Special Forces Group. Mm-hmm. And I worked in there for about 6 weeks until I got my orders from Vietnam.
Okay. And where was the 7th Special
Forces? At Fort Bragg.
At Fort Bragg also.
Right.
Okay. So you spent, you said, about 7 weeks there before?
Yeah.
Before receiving your orders?
Right, for Vietnam.
All right. Once you received those orders, how did you feel about it?
Oh, I wanted to go.
You were ready to go. Okay. How did your family react to your?
Well, my mom and dad weren't crazy about it. I don't think either one of my brothers were too upset.
Mm-hmm.
My grandparents obviously were upset.
Mm-hmm. All right. And by the time you received the orders, when was this? This was.
I got to Vietnam in. In May of, early May of 66.
Okay, early May of 66, all right. How did you get there? By commercial?
Continental Airlines.
Continental Airlines, okay. What was the mood like on the plane right over?
Quiet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so no real conversations about what was to come or?
No.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. At this point, you being a Green Beret, did the interaction with just the regular soldiers, did they treat you differently being a Green Beret?
No. Well, I didn't have much interaction with just regular soldiers.
Okay. Right. Okay. All right. Did you have any on this plane ride over? Were there any stopovers? Where did you stop?
Oh, we stopped at Honolulu and Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines.
Okay.
And then Tonsonay.
Okay. So you arrived in Tonsonay. Okay. How long were you in Saigon before being assigned elsewhere?
Well, I got at Tonsonay. Everybody went through Tonsonay at that mm-hmm. time.
Okay.
Except for the Marines and I Corps.
Right.
And they just. I was afraid I was going to get. They didn't act like I was going to go to a Special Forces unit.
Mm-hmm.
And there happened to be a sergeant major in Saigon of Special Forces happened to be there, and so I latched on to him, and he bailed me out really fast when he found out I was a medic, and got me downtown to, I think it was called Camp Carroll, which was in downtown Saigon, and I'm not even sure about that.
Okay.
But it was in downtown Saigon. I spent like 2 days there, and then went to caught a caribou up to our headquarters in the train.
Okay.
The 5th Special Forces Group headquarters in the train.
Was there anything else to end processing? Just
very little.
Very little to it. Okay.
Once this sergeant, once I found this sergeant major, and I just happened to see him walking across the yard, and I, you know, went up to him and says, "Hey, I need to get out of here." He got me. He said, "Come on with me." And I mean, that was it.
Okay. And had that not happened, you would have been just assigned to a regular unit, probably.
I don't know that for a fact, but it was enough to make me nervous. You know?
Sure. Okay. Well, did you get to see any of the city in the short time you were there?
No, not very much at that time. I went back later on for a couple of times and for a little R&R.
Right.
But no length of time in any of it. It was a nice city, though.
Okay. So had you, when did you receive your orders once you were in country?
Well, I got assigned to the dispensary in the train at headquarters.
Okay.
The chief medic in country, and I think his name was Sergeant Owsley, but he didn't like his young medics to go out to a regular A camp without a little bit more training. And it was just working around the dispensary, and finally I told him, I said, "This is bullshit. I didn't come over here to work in a fucking dispensary.
Right.
Get me out of here." And there were two guys in there that, ahead of me, that should have gotten to go out before I did. And I don't know if Alvin liked me or didn't like me, but he let me go.
Okay.
And that's when I went to I Corps, and I spent the rest of my time in I Corps, which is the 5 or 7 northern provinces.
Right, right. All right. And this dispensary, where you work in the dispensary, you're just taking care of minor wounds and things?
Yeah, VD.
Right.
Minor wounds. A lot of guys had vasectomies done over there, and I assisted in doing vasectomies. Just normal crap. Fevers.
Right.
Making sure people took their medicine. Their malaria tablets, just, you know, general crap.
Okay. All right. And were you ever able to get out in this, into the field at all?
Yeah, I got to go. I was there. I was actually stationed there about 7 weeks, and for 2 weeks of that time, I went to a camp that didn't have any medics at all. In between, and I don't even remember the name of that camp, but it was between the train and Cameron Bay.
Okay.
And I went out and went on patrols there and stuff like that, because they didn't have a medic at all, so they would farm medics out like that.
Okay. Did on any of these patrols, did you ever have contact with the enemy?
Once.
Okay. What do you remember about that?
Kind of nothing. We killed this poor little kid. You know, I mean, he wasn't a kid. He looked very young, but he wasn't a kid. He was a VC. He was carrying an old French weapon, and at that particular camp, I worked with the Vietnamese Special Forces and the Vietnamese. We had Vietnamese CIDG, Civil Irregular Defense Group.
Right.
Okay. There was originally a CIA operation that had been turned over to the Army. And I worked with them, but they knew a hell of a lot more than I did, you know.
What was your first impressions of the Vietnamese?
The Vietnamese troops, CIDG troops, were okay, not great. You had to be very careful with them. And you just, you know, it was very easy to hurt their feelings. And loss of face is a lot to an OEM, you know, so you had to be real careful with them.
Okay. All right.
Well, this wasn't a real hot area by any means. I mean, it was, you know, the train was was an R&R place for the Americans and the VC. Now, I don't know how true that was.
Right. Okay. Well, what about the your first impressions? That's, since we're on this subject, the Vietnamese civilians. What did you think of them?
They were people that were stuck in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Right. Okay. So you were here at the train for how long again?
About 7 weeks altogether, but I had been farmed out for 2 weeks to the southern camp.
Okay. About 2 weeks, all right. And is that when you received your assignment to A107?
Yeah, that's when I went to I Corps.
To I Corps.
Went to Trebon.
Okay. All right. How did you get up there to
Trebon? Caribou, I think.
Okay. All right. Could you describe Trebon itself for me?
Trebon is one of the most beautiful places you'll ever see. It's got this river running in between two. It's in a valley. It's got a pretty fast flowing river. It would be a Garden of Eden. I mean, it was an absolutely gorgeous spot.
Mm-hmm.
Have you looked it up on the map? It's back towards the Laotian border.
Okay.
About halfway.
All right. I can't remember. Which province is it in?
It's in Quang Ngoc province.
Quang Ngoc province.
Right.
Okay.
Which was a hot province. And Trebon was a hot camp. In January, they had one of the biggest ambushes of Americans took place, and they killed 6 Americans. The district chief, the LLDB, the Vietnamese Special Forces chief, and like I say, 6 Americans were killed, and just about wiped out they killed half the team.
Mm-hmm.
And the other half, it was a brand new team that had been in country less than a month.
Mm-hmm.
When the ambush took place.
Right.
It also, Trebon was an old Australian camp also. And they had, one of the guys that, of the 2 or 3 Victoria Crosses, were, one of them was at Trebon.
Okay.
On another ambush that they killed 2 of the Australians.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it was a hot camp. Quang Ngoc province was a hot area. It's, as a matter of fact, that's where the original revolution started in Quang Ngoc province.
Okay.
And I read that someplace and I don't remember where.
All right. Well, what about the base there? Could you tell me a little bit about your...
It was, A107 was set up on a hill right next to the river. It had an inner compound of Americans. That's a painting a friend of mine did of it.
Okay.
Had an inner camp with a concrete blockhouse to be the Alamo if we ever needed it.
Mm-hmm.
It was very bare. We had a combination of Vietnamese and mountain yard troops.
Mm-hmm.
For our CIDG. The Vietnamese were totally treacherous.
Mm.
You could not trust them at all. The mountain yards were pretty good.
Okay.
They were one of the most, I think they were rays.
Okay.
And they were one of the most primitive of the mountain yard groups. They didn't have numbers. They didn't have a language. They had a language. They didn't have numbers at all.
Mm-hmm. All right. You mentioned the Vietnamese being treacherous. What types of things would they do?
Well, they would steal. Mm-hmm. They you couldn't trust them on a patrol not to run off and leave you.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a portion of them were VC
mm-hmm.
that had infiltrated the camp.
Right.
You just couldn't trust them.
Okay. All right. But the mountain yards, for the most part, were pretty good, though?
The mountain yards were good.
Okay. All right. About how many people were based at Trabong?
I think we had around 300 CIDG,
mm-hmm.
Two Australians, and any place up to 10 Americans.
Okay.
And that varied day to day.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you went in to Da Nang to scrounge food. We were on separate rations over there.
Mm-hmm.
So we went in and scrounged our food from the Navy bases all around Da Nang.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Food, beer, and...
Right. All right. Well, you said it was 300, so this is all of A107, is this 300-something people?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And how often would Trabong come under attack?
It never came under attack while I was there.
Okay. All right.
Well, we had numerous contacts up the valley where the ambush had taken place.
Okay.
And we used to patrol up there. We would try to send operations up there on an average of once a month or twice a month, and we always made contact.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes just snipers, sometimes a platoon, but we always made contact going up the valley.
Okay. All right.
And they were local VC.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about A107's primary duties here? What was the...
Well, they were we were a border camp. We had surveillance on the border. There was infiltration coming through there.
Mm-hmm.
It was, like I say, a hotbed of the VC area.
Mm-hmm.
Quang Ngai province, particularly further down the valley from where we were, it was, and out towards the Marine base at Chu Lai.
Right. Okay. What was the, you said never coming under attack, but what was there a contingency plan? Was there a backup units to help in case,
Yeah, they were supposed to be.
Okay.
But the Marines were supposed to, at this time, I Corps was the Marine Corps area.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they were the primarily responsible for it. So they were our backups if something were to go really wrong,
mm-hmm.
Like Ashau.
Right.
The camp at Ashau, they were supposed to come in and relieve Ashau, but they never would do it because that's what the VC wanted them to do. I mean, you know, so they could ambush them.
Right. Okay.
And again at Long Bay, they did the same thing at Long Bay. They were supposed to be the backup for Long Bay, and they didn't come into Long Bay
mm-hmm.
when the tanks came in.
Right, right.
Now, a friend of mine was at Long Bay with the Mike Force, and he lives in Albuquerque. If you want his name, he's a really interesting guy.
Okay.
His great-great-grandfather is Jubal Early.
Oh, wow. Okay. Right, yeah.
He's a really interesting guy to talk.
Okay. All right. Afterwards, I might have.
Right.
I'll ask you about that. You mentioned the two Australians. What was the relationship with them? Was it just fairly normal relationship?
I got along very good with them. Some of the other guys didn't like them very mm-hmm. much, but I liked them a lot.
Mm-hmm.
One guy was an older guy that was kind of an asshole,
mm-hmm.
And didn't spend a lot of time in the field. And the other guy was, I got to be very good friends with, and his name was Wendy Windbank.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. He and I did a lot of med caps. He was a civic action officer, and we did a lot of med caps.
Okay.
In downtown Trabong.
Oh, right. One thing I remember, you wrote in your summary that you gave us. You said when you first got there, he was the one to meet you there.
Yeah, he picked me up at the airfield.
Right.
The airfield was down, was about half a mile away from the camp.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't contiguous with the camp. And as a matter of fact, Air America brought me in and dropped me off at the district headquarters, or dropped me off at the airstrip, which was across the street from the district headquarters. And there wasn't anybody there. Nobody told them I was coming. There wasn't anybody there to meet me. So I'm sitting out in the middle of this fairly busy little field, mm-hmm. Trabon, and I'm the only round eye around.
Right.
And I was like, shit.
Sure.
And this guy happened to come driving along. He says, "What are you doing out here, mate?"
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Well, I'm the new medic." He said, "Oh, good. We were expecting you. Just not today."
Right.
So he brought me back in. And,
mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Can you tell me a little bit about some of these MedCap?
We would go downtown and work in the village. When there was another medic, we'd go down together, but a lot of the times I was the only one there, so we'd go down and just treat people. They all had terrible teeth because of their diet,
mm-hmm.
Which was mainly rice. We would go downtown and pull their teeth. I found one little girl that had her tooth had abscessed so badly, it had abscessed to the outside, and there was actually a hole in her jaw that you could look up and see her jaw,
right,
from the exterior. And I ended up sending her to Denain.
Mm-hmm.
Another old lady I picked up had stepped on a punchy stick, and her foot was infected, and it was like this big.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started treating her with penicillin and streptomycin. The kids over there had a tendency to get the babies to get what we call it scruffy head, but they'd get scabs all over their head,
okay,
just from being dirty. And we would take them, scrub them down, put antibiotic ointment on it, and it was gone within a day.
Mm-hmm.
Just all sorts of things like that, you know.
Right.
Any malaria. Quite a bit of malaria, obviously.
Okay. All right. Well, did you find the people of Trabon fairly friendly, or how were they?
No, they weren't overly friendly to the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
We were not winning the hearts and minds.
Okay.
By any means.
All right. All right. Oh, how often would you go on these MedCap missions?
Not once a week.
Not once a week. Okay. Well, as far as the other operations, the other missions with A107, could you take me through, if there was such a thing, just a typical day with A107, if there was such a thing?
You'd get up in the morning, you'd probably pull guard duty the night before because there might only be five or six guys in camp or something,
mm-hmm.
between operations. You'd pull a... I would go out with the troops and see if any of them were sick, have a little medic, sick call type situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the primary rat catcher, and we had thousands of rats. And I'd go out and kill the rats that we had in the traps. Let's see. Then the rest of the time, you might just kind of practice with get one of the weapons guys to let you shoot his mortar or something like that, so you'd learn how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How often would you go out on patrols and ambushes?
Maybe every 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I went in on one really long 10-day deal, and it was done with a guy by the name of Lee Barnes, who's a professor at the Las Vegas Community College, creative writing, and he and I went out for about 10 days, and we were way back into Laos. into the cinnamon forest and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that was kind of neat. They the French had planted cinnamon trees, and they were ready to harvest and stuff, but nobody was there to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So the mountain yards would bring it in, and we would take it into the Dane, trade it, and give the mountain yards the money then.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, Ceylon was the only cinnamon producer in the world, so it was worth a lot of money, and to the best of my knowledge, it's still not being anything done with it today.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Well, could you tell me, talking about going on these patrols and these ambushes, could you tell me the tactics about how say, an ambush would work?
Well, we'd go out, and we had scouted it out and say, a bird dog or something, and we would go out and set up, and usually we would set up an L-shaped ambush or something.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time they weren't successful. Occasionally they were.
Okay.
But L-type ambushes is what we normally did. Now the long patrol Barnes and I went on were just he and I and six Vietnamese, and we were out, we were way out by ourselves. If we had gotten hit, we would have been all over, because we were all the way back in the Laos.
Okay. Was this for recon purposes?
Right.
Okay. And were most of the times you go, would it be for recon? And
yeah.
And so you're not looking for contact in that?
No, we're not really looking for contact. You're really just looking,
right?
To see what's out there.
Mm-hmm. And if you saw the enemy, what would the response be?
Well, in some cases, you'd let them go, and if they were bigger than you were,
mm-hmm.
And try and call in airstrike if they were smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly on A, once we get into A-100, you would,
right.
You would try and get them.
Okay. All right. Was there any other specific missions or operations that stand out?
No, not really.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about the team itself? And
well, the team itself, as it started out, it was of course I was the junior guy there. I'd been in country, 2 months,
mm-hmm.
So I was not privy to all the politics that was going on within this particular team.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a really hard break with the big ambush where the team leader and these other guys had gotten killed.
Right.
And some of the guys that came in, Ralph Whitten, one of the Australians, was definitely disliked because they didn't think he pulled his weight. J.V. Carroll, who was the team sergeant, was having a drinking problem. He jumped into Arnhem in Holland in World War II, so he's in the, and he did 2 jumps in Korea, but he turned into an alcoholic, and he was having definite problems.
Mm-hmm.
And he would send us out on dumb operations. The team leader himself, the one that came in that I knew best, was a guy by the name of Horan, who graduated last in his class at West Point.
Mm-hmm.
And was an absolute idiot, one of the poorest officers I ever saw. My senior medic was a really good guy, who I'm still in contact with. Barnes, I'm still, he was the engineer, and I'm still in contact with him. And there were some good and some bad, but it was a team with definite problems.
Mm-hmm. How did this dynamic and this relationship, how did it affect the performance, or did it affect the performance?
Oh, yeah. J.B., on 2 occasions that I know of, sent us up on the, we went up the valley to this village and got hit pretty hard both times we got up there.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept saying, we needed to do it different than we were, but we didn't, so.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't lose any Americans, but we did lose some Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned combat before, and could you tell me, if you don't mind, tell me, what do you remember the most about combat itself?
Well, you were super busy. You were super busy, and what may have taken 30 seconds seemed like a long time sometimes. And other times it seemed like it was a snap of a finger.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It was an adrenaline rush, and it was scary. And I mean, you know, when somebody's shooting at you, it makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, as a medic, as a special forces medic, so is your responsibility fight until someone's wounded, and then your responsibility switch, or how does that work?
Well, each situation is different.
Mm-hmm.
If you had enough people, you would let them do the fighting,
mm-hmm.
and you would take care of the guy.
Right.
If not, you would just kind of split up your time between them, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, you mentioned going back to the relationship with the team members. If you don't mind telling me, you mentioned a particular incident between you and one of the other members.
Yeah. Well. Okay. Well, that's J.V. Carroll. They ended up relieving J.V. because he was just drinking too much.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got a new team sergeant. A guy by the name of. Shit, I can't even think of his name now. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Right.
But he was a blowhard. He was a big fat guy, and he was a blowhard. And at this time, the monsoons were starting, and our trenches were caving in. Lee Barnes, who was the engineer in charge of all that stuff, had left.
Mm-hmm.
And I became the new engineer.
Okay.
And the trenches were caving in around the Alamo, and I was putting up revetments, and in the meantime, the captain's bunker started leaking, and they made me quit putting up revetments on the trenches to take the top off his bunker because they didn't want him to get wet, you know. He and the Horan and this team sergeant.
Okay.
And anyway, it pissed me off that we were doing something that didn't need to be done. I mean, you know, all the bunkers leaked.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that night, he tried to buddy up to me, and I told him that I was pissed off about it. And he said, well, you either do what I tell you, or I'm going to kick your butt.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I carried a shotgun most of the time in camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, okay, come on, let's do it. You know.
Right.
And I had been drinking. We had beer out there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we had liquor and stuff. And if you weren't on duty, they expected you to drink. I mean, and there wasn't anything against it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the next morning, there was a helicopter picking me up, getting me out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, I barely had time to pack my clothes.
Wow. Right. Okay.
Fortunately, now let me go. I'll just go ahead with the rest of the narrative. Fortunately, I was a medic, and medics were gold.
Mm-hmm.
So they took me into the B team at Quang Ngai, and I spent the night there. And the next morning, a friend of mine, Captain Beeson,
mm-hmm.
was taken over A-104. Hatan. And I told him what had happened, and he knew both of these guys were jerks. Beeson was an ex NCO, Special Forces NCO, that had come up through the ranks and had gotten a commission at OCS and had come back into Special Forces. So he was quite familiar with what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, just come with me. And I said, well, I've got orders to go into Da Nang to see the sergeant major. And he said, no, nah, just fucking, you know, just come with me.
Right.
So I did. Mm-hmm. And he protected me then for about 3 or 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
While these guys were still after my ass.
Right.
But I was the only medic in camp, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, had he not interceded, what do you think would have happened? What did they want to happen to you?
Oh, I think I would have gone to the 173rd.
Oh, okay.
So or the 101st. Or
so completely out of Special Forces.
Yeah, I think that's a good possibility, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
With the exception that since I was a medic, they may have busted me or fined me or something like that. But I really was concerned about getting taken out of Special Forces.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you think that morning when the helicopter showed up? I mean, did they say?
Oh, fuck, I knew I was in trouble.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, did they? Whenever they came to pick you up, did they say anything?
They just said you got orders to go to the night.
Okay.
That's what the captain told me.
All right. Okay. Well, before moving on to A-104, is there anything else about A-107 that you'd want to mention?
No, it was just kind of a hard luck camp that had really taken a beating.
Mm-hmm.
And had never quite come back from it. You know?
Mm-hmm. And had this the new team members and all that, had that played into the problems?
I'm sure it had, yeah.
Okay.
And it was the young guys against the old guys. The three technical MOSs, the medics, the commo guys, and the engineers,
mm-hmm.
were all typically younger than the weapons guys, the intel guys, and the officers.
Okay.
And they were probably, for the most part, smarter.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't lifers, which the other guys were. So, I mean, they were... There was always a general tension amongst the groups.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, you said that A-104, you were based at Hatan. Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about Hatan?
Hatan was had just gotten hit whenever I got there, just before I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And the camp had been mortared, but nobody in the wire or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Their medic, I don't know where their medic, he just rotated out. So they didn't have any medic, so that's one of the reason I got to go there.
Mm-hmm.
The team leader was very good, Captain Beeson.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the rest of the guys were pretty good. It was overall a nice camp.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Again, it's in Quang Nai province, and it was a hot area.
Okay. What about this team, and how it worked together? Was it?
It worked much better than the Chabong team did.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And was it basically the same setup as the size of the group, about 500 something?
Okay. Yeah, it was a combination mountain yard Vietnamese on a small hilltop. Again, the airport, the airfield was not contiguous to the camp.
Okay.
It had an inter-American perimeter, just like the Trabang did.
Mm-hmm.
And overall, I enjoyed my time there at Trabang, or at Hatan.
Okay. And how long were you there?
I was there from October until about the 1st of January.
Okay.
With a TDY to the Force Recon with the Marines.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to ask you about. But before we get into that, were the duties, were your duties and the duties of A-104 pretty much the same?
Right. Yeah, I was a team medic, and I took care of the Americans, pulled sick call with the Vietnamese medics, went downtown, did med caps, just general stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then Hatan, did it ever come under any sort of attack or mortar fire or anything?
It had come under mortars just before I got there.
Okay, not while I was not there. Nothing happened.
Okay. We did have a scare one night that our interpreter came running in and he said there's a bunch of guys coming up the road with ladders. Mm-hmm. And ladders were, they'd throw the ladders on the wire and cross the wire into the camp. And it turned out that it was a Buddhist funeral, and they were coming up the road with lanterns.
Lanterns, okay. A little misunderstanding there.
And that's the kind of thing you run into with interpreters.
Right. Sure. Okay. Well, how about the mountain yards here and the Vietnamese here?
Again, they were the mountain yards were good. Vietnamese again were not very good. As a matter of fact, we came off a patrol just before Thanksgiving, and they turned on us and set up machine guns outside our team house. So we're going to shoot our team house up, and our Captain Beeson went out and negotiated with them not to shoot us.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a misunderstanding. We'd been out on a long operation and on a kind of a four-prong operation with the ROCs and the American Marines, and it had been four really wet, cold days during the monsoon, and everybody was on edge, and it was just a misunderstanding of some variety that we pissed them off.
Right. How often would conflicts like this happen?
Well, that's the only time I ever saw them set guns up on us.
Right.
But okay. Conflicts went on continuously.
Mm-hmm. And what types of things would you have to do to appease them, to get them to back down or whatever?
Well, we were, most of it centered around operations, getting the Vietnamese Special Forces to go out on operations.
Mm-hmm.
And, consequently, we'd just have to cajole them. We'd hold out their food or hold out money or something like that to keep them,
mm-hmm.
to make them do things.
Right.
And we were only the advisors in these camps.
Right.
So we couldn't command them to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did they ever, you mentioned earlier in the interview about either your Montagnards or the Vietnamese possibly leaving in the middle of a firefighter. Did that ever happen during this time period?
Not to me, but it happened to one of the other guys I knew.
Mm-hmm.
They all split on him.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to run to keep up with him.
Right. Was this Montagnards or the Vietnamese?
Both.
Okay. All right.
The Montagnards were better. But neither one of them could stand up to a concentrated firefight. They were strictly light infantry,
Okay.
And the big ambush at Trabang, most of them cut out on the Americans, and that's why the Americans were there by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up getting killed, along with the LLDB and the district chief. So.
Okay. All right. How often would patrols and things come under fire here when you were with A-104?
At first, not at all.
Mm-hmm.
After I got back from the Marines, gearing just before Tet,
mm-hmm.
just before the Tet holiday, and I mentioned it, is I ran a big ambush that I got a bunch of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it was a big firefight all the way down the valley from then on.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And 2 days later, they went out again and got some more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to ask you about that, but I guess to keep in chronological order, before we get to that ambush in particular, can you tell me about how you got assigned to the Marine Force Recon? How did that come about?
They were just running a cross program, Some of their guys came out and stayed with us, and they sent us in to stay with them. And we went out on operations with the 4th Recon and Battalion Recon. They were very good troops. They were normally younger than the Special Forces guys were. Particularly the Battalion Recon were 19, 20-year-old guys.
Okay. How long were you with them?
I spent a month.
Okay, a month with them.
And it was a lot of fun. They were really good troops. Mm-hmm. Particularly the 4th Recon guys had field technique that was unbelievable. Mm-hmm.
Well, that brings up a question. Did they operate much differently than any differently than?
Yeah, they did. They operated more like our SOG guys did.
Okay.
When you were with a regular ACAN, a CIDG group, the field, when you're out in the field, discipline is pretty lax.
Mm-hmm.
They smoked and they laughed and they, you know, stopped and ate.
Right.
But the 4th Recon guys were very, very field conscious.
Okay.
Had a lot of field discipline. No smoking, face paint. But they were complete strangers in this area, whereas our Vietnamese, this was their home. So
right.
They looked at it completely differently.
Okay. All right. Well, let's see. Was their overall mission different?
Yeah, they were just strictly reconnaissance for the Marines, and
right.
Whereas we were trying to run any guerrilla operations.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Plus border camp surveillance.
Right. All right. Well, did you have any difficulty adjusting to their way of doing things?
No.
Okay.
The one thing you learn in Special Forces that's repeated over and over again is to be flexible.
Okay.
You know, I think most of us were.
Right. All right. Were there any particular memorable missions with them?
No.
All right. Okay, well, after your month with them, you came back to A1 and 4, right?
Right.
And then, if you don't mind, could you tell me about that one particular firefight? I believe you said it was December 31st, 66. Yeah.
Right.
Could you describe that one for me?
Oh, we had gotten up. We got up. We left the camp before daylight, like about 4 o'clock in the morning, and proceeded up the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And about daylight, we set up an ambush. An L-shaped ambush in some trees and a little draw type of affair.
Okay.
And within 5 minutes, we had 4 guys walk into the ambush.
Mm-hmm.
And my Vietnamese and mountain guards immediately killed all 4 of them.
Mm-hmm.
What we didn't realize was there was another. The rest of the company was right behind them, and these guys were just the point.
Okay.
So guys started surrounding us, and we started retreating back down the valley, and I started calling in airstrikes.
Mm-hmm.
And they were yelling at us to stop, just what my Vietnamese told me. And to stand and fight them, and I called in airstrikes on them.
Mm-hmm.
And made it back to camp, you know. Without any casualties, but they asked between. We actually got 4 guys.
Okay, we're recording now. All right. When we left off, we were talking about Marine Recon Force and just about their operations. That you said you were based at Chu Lai.
Correct.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about Chu Lai?
Well, I didn't see that much of it, but it was just a Marine combat base, and they. The 4th Recon guys were there, and the Battalion Recon, and one of the Marine divisions, but I couldn't even begin to tell you which one was based there.
Mm-hmm.
And they just did combat operations primarily in the lowlands coming out from Chu Lai.
Okay.
They also did some, they had a lot of artillery there, and they did H&I fire.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, they accidentally shelled us at Trebon one night. Dropped 4105s in on our camp. But beyond that, I don't really know a lot about Chulai outside of that.
This accidental shelling at Trebon, were they short rounds or what?
I don't know.
You don't know? Yeah, just was anyone injured?
Yeah, a couple of the boys were hurt. We called the indigenous Vietnamese and we called them our boys. But a couple of the boys were hurt real bad, and they ended up going to Quang Ngai and at the Vietnamese hospital there, and I went to visit them a couple of days later, and you just reeked of gangrene, and I'm sure they ended up dying. But
okay, all right. Well, the other thing we were talking about was the December 31st ambush.
Right.
You had described that to me, but. You also mentioned in your summary that you gave us that you received a blackjack message for this operation. What do you mean by that?
Blackjack, Colonel Francis Kelly was by this time in charge of countrywide special forces. And he was based out of the train, but he, and his code name was Blackjack. And he would, when you would get attaboy messages, they were blackjack messages.
Okay. All right. Did you tell me a little bit about Colonel Kelly?
Well, all I ever knew him was by reputation. I never met him, never saw him. But he was a go-getter, apparently. He set up the first mobile guerrilla force operations, which really weren't guerrilla force operations. They were ranger raids more than they were guerrilla force, but because we weren't living with the indigenous people at all. But anyway, that's what they were called.
Okay.
And they were called blackjacks, as a matter of fact, also. So he was quite theatrical about some of his code names and stuff like that. And I, like I say, I know nothing about him out beyond that. So
okay. When you say theatrical, though, could you elaborate a little on that?
Well, like the blackjack operation. He had blackjack operations, and he had blackjack messages that, when you did good, he would send you a blackjack.
Right. Okay. I see what you're saying. All right. Well, this December 31st firefight, was this your last action with A-104? Or?
Right.
Okay. So right after this, you went to
A-100?
Okay. All right. Was there anything else you'd like to say about A-104 before?
It was just a group of good people and good camp.
Okay. All right. Well, moving on to A-100 then, you mentioned in your summary that the elite of an elite unit. Can you tell me about why that is?
Well, we were the mobile guerrilla force, and they were, Kelly handpicked each one of us from our records and stuff to go in there. And I had been kind of under a black cloud due to my troubles in Trebon.
Right.
But I'd spent a month with the Marines, and I'd gone on some operations, and then had this big operation on the 31st of December. And so Kelly immediately transfers me to the Mobile Guerrilla Force, which at that time was rebuilding from an operation they had been on in November and December, which they had a multitude of problems on. They almost starved to death. They couldn't get, it was during the monsoon, and they couldn't get in food to them. And they had left an American body, which is a great mistake.
Well, sorry, I was kind of.
And had to go back in and get him.
Well, thinking of the monsoons, how would they affect operations?
Oh, it was wet and cold. And you stayed wet and cold for couple of months.
Mm.
And Vietnam can be very chilly.
Okay.
Particularly in the highlands, you know.
Mm. All right. Well, could you tell me a little bit more about this? I'm sorry, I'm jumping around a little bit, but about this mission where they left the body behind. What happened there?
Have you ever read Morley Safer's book?
No, I haven't.
Well, in this book, he says that there was an operation between the 2 Corps and I Corps Special Forces to go into the Cambodian Laotian area,
mm-hmm.
where it ties into Vietnam, to kidnap General Zhao.
Mm-hmm.
And we think, we don't know, but we think that's probably what they were trying to do. And fortunately, they ended up saying, no, it would never work. We could never get you guys out.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up sending them into the Ashau Valley, where the Ashau Special Forces camp had been overrun the previous year.
Mm-hmm.
And the VC had turned it into a superhighway to, I say the VC, actually the NVA had turned it into a superhighway coming into I Corps.
Okay. Could you describe the Ashau Valley to me, just what it looked like and just a description of it?
Well, it's a triple canopy, very mountainous, very steep mountains. A lot of fog. The weather is generally poor. There were, at one time, there was a Louis Ashau in Quezon and Camp Duk.
Okay.
And they were all right back on the Laotian border.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all overrun at one time or another.
Mm-hmm. So this was a main infiltration area for the North Vietnamese then?
They took, it had a PSP runway, and they, the VC or the NVA took it up and paved a road through much of the valley with the PSP that we had left from the Special Forces camp.
Okay. All right. And this mission you were just talking about, you came in right after this?
I came in after that mission.
Okay.
And there were only a couple of the Australians left from that operation.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe only one of the Australians left. Maybe Barry Ross was the only one, but I don't remember exactly, but probably only Barry.
Okay. All right. Well, where exactly was A-100 based?
We were at the foot of... we were at Marble Mountain Airfield in Da Nang, just, I think, kind of south of there,
mm-hmm.
in between Marble Mountain itself and the Marble Mountain Airstrip.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, that's where our troops were, we had them billeted there, and that's where we had our own billets down. And it was at the bottom of the hill from the C-team.
Okay.
Camp.
All right. Well, what was your living? What was your living space like there?
Well, it was a room about this size, and we had bunks, and it was nice. We had our own bar,
mm-hmm.
and plus the C-team bar was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It was right on the beach.
Okay.
And the swimming was great. Bad undertows, so you had to be careful there. But it was a great place, you know.
Okay. So this was a different type setup than say with A-107 and.
Yeah, out on the A camps was very primitive.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, you didn't even have paved floors in your team house or anything. I mean, it was dirt. And it was, and we were the advisors. Whereas on A100, we commanded these guys.
Okay. All right. That's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, just the differences in Mobile Guerrilla Force and this. Could you tell me a little bit about the MGF, the Mobile Guerrilla Force, and how it works?
The Mobile Guerrilla Force was set up to run long-range operations back into NVA base camps. Mm-hmm. And we did a certain amount of recon by fire. And we were actively going after the NVA in these back in their base areas. We were resupplied by air. At least they tried to resupply us once a week. The guys on the first A100 operation, the weather turned really bad on them and they couldn't get in resupply. And they, like I say, they almost starved to death. We never had that big a problem, but it was a problem because the way they resupplied us was with A1E SPADs, and the SPADs would run an APOM operation near us, and then they would drop, our resupply was in napalm canisters, and they would drop them on top of us, and we would retrieve them. We had food, new clothes if you needed it. I had a dental kit sent in one time because I forgot to bring a dental kit with me. Just first one, whatever you needed. They were ammunition, grenades.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so this was designed to cover up your right. presence there.
Right.
Okay. Would they follow that up with a real napalm strike? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
And also they would drop a... They used to drop what we called it, gravel, behind us. And I don't know if you have you ever heard of this. Or,
no, sir.
It's mines that are only about this big, and they deteriorate after a certain period of time and go inert.
Okay.
But they would drop them in behind us, and it was enough to break your foot.
Okay.
It wouldn't kill you or anything, but it would keep people off your butts.
Right. Okay. Well, how were the, the A100 itself, what was its makeup? Was it similar to A104, A107?
Yeah, we had I believe 8 Americans and 4 Australians. And the Australians were the platoon commanders, and then the rest of us were, of course, the company commander was Jules Bonavolani, and he was the company commander, and then the platoon commanders answered to him. Mm-hmm. And then we had the Como guys, a couple of weapons guys that were assistant platoon commanders, and then a couple of medics.
Okay.
One of the medics was with the recon platoon. We had a recon platoon. And I was with, when I got hit, I was with the recon platoon, but I think I was with one of the Rod A platoons anyway.
Okay. All right. Well, how about the mountain yards and the Vietnamese here?
Okay, we had no Vietnamese at all.
Okay, so it was all
they were all mountain yards, and they were recruited from the Coho tribe around the lot. Okay. And the Rades at Bounty to it.
Okay. Were they pretty good troops?
They were excellent.
All right. And you said in this case, you're not an advisor anymore. You're commanding these troops.
That's correct.
And did they have any problems taking orders? Or were they
no,
always
they
very
were, good? They were very good.
Okay. All right. Before we get to it, I know you mentioned, let's see, we're talking about an operation you mentioned in January of 67, you mentioned in the summary, you recon platoon was sent out to the Atoll and surrounded.
Right.
Yeah.
Within hours.
Was this right after you had been assigned to A-100?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, can you tell me about this?
The recon was sent out to the Ashau Valley in the hopes of running another operation out there.
Mm-hmm.
And within, like, say, hours, they were totally surrounded. They were in a B-52 crater, totally surrounded and taking fire. So they gathered the rest of us up. We were just doing our normal jobs of pulling sick call and first, you know, taking care of equipment. And we loaded into helicopters and flew out there and circled around for hours.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, we circled around so much we had to go back to Fubai, Wade Fubai, to get some more gas.
Mm-hmm.
And we circled around there for hours, and the Marines finally went in and got them out.
Okay.
The Marine helicopters finally went in and got them out. Landing in this, two helicopters came in one after the other and landed in this B-52 crater and got the guys out.
Mm-hmm. All right. How many people were in this recon platoon?
Probably, I'm guessing, 25 maybe. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Plus three Americans.
Mm-hmm. And did they take heavy casualties in this?
Yeah, we lost a couple of the yards that day.
Mm-hmm.
A couple were wounded, and I think two were killed, maybe three were killed.
Okay.
None of the Americans, fortunately, but...
All right. But the rest of you were, I guess, in reserve to rescue them in case the Marines were unable to do
so. Yeah, we would have all gotten screwed if we had to go in there. But.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say about that mission or that operation? Okay. You also talked about one in your summary about a training mission at Dong Duk.
Where we shot each other up.
Right. Yeah. Could you tell me about that?
Dong Duk set on was another special forces camp, and we it sets on a river, and we went up on a, there's a plateau just very near it. We went up on top of this plateau just kind of as a shakedown mission.
Mm-hmm.
And the Rod A, I believe it was the Rod A troops went out on a patrol from where we were going to have our night encampment.
Mm-hmm.
And as they were coming back in, and again due to the fact that they don't speak the same language,
right,
the Coho and the Rod A, as they were coming back in, the Coho opened up on them.
Mm-hmm.
And we shot two or three of our own guys. Barry Russ was the platoon leader, and he and another guy were down behind a tree that they say was this wide that was being cut down over their heads.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time we got on the stomp, so we're come down off of this mountain in the middle of pitch black, middle of the night, carrying, you know, two or three guys.
Mm-hmm. Were there other incidences where this friendly fire incidents has happened, or?
No, that's the only friendly fire one that I was involved in.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of the Marines shelling us that one.
Right.
Okay. But this was just because of the language, I mean, as much as anything.
Right. Did the tribes seem to, the different tribes, the Rade and the
Coho,
did they seem to get along?
No.
They did not.
No,
okay.
They didn't dislike each other, but if you showed any favoritism at all,
right,
you know, it was, you know, well, the Coho boys are getting more than we're getting, or the Rade boys are getting more than we're getting, or, you know.
Right.
So you had to be very careful and treat everybody the same, or try to, you know.
Right. Well, talking about favoritism, was there Did you prefer one group or the other? Was one group better fighters than the other, or is it pretty much the same?
Probably the Rade were slightly better than the Cohos.
Okay. All right. And one thing I want to ask you about, communication with them. How many translators would you have?
Sometimes with the mountain yards, you would have to translate. You would have to tell the Vietnamese interpreter something. He in turn would have to tell a mountain yard that spoke Vietnamese something. So that's where you come into your double translators.
Okay.
And things can really get confused doing the, obviously, you know, it's like starting a sentence around the room.
Sure.
And so yeah, that was a problem, particularly in the camps with the Rade and the Coho. Both had we had Rade and Coho boys that both spoke English, so they were our translators. We didn't have to go through the Vietnamese.
Okay.
We didn't have any Vietnamese with us anyway. But.
Okay. All right. Well, you mentioned earlier about earlier when we were talking about your training for this, that sometimes there would be mistranslations or purposely mistranslated, whatever. Was there any problem like that here? Where
I don't believe so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So no misunderstandings or
no. These guys were definitely. We paid them very well, and we paid them the same as an American.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were quite happy with their pay, and they were quite willing to do what we wanted them to do until the end. I mean, and then I can talk to you about that later on.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah, before we talk about that, you also mentioned an operation at Minh Long.
Yeah, that's probably where Bert Small was captured, was Minh Long, maybe.
Okay. All right. And then there's, of course, the big operation, the one that you...
Coney, yeah.
Coney, yeah. Could you...
Blackjack 12.
Okay. Could you tell me about it?
Okay, it started out, we helicoptered... on CH-46s, we were dropped off with the Mike Force, and we ran a parallel to each other for a day or 2 days maybe, and then the Mike Force got picked up, and we were left in there supposedly unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And from there we walked for about, I don't know, 20 days. And we were pretty far back. We had passed the Nam Dong area. On one occasion, we saw a lot of VC. Or not VC, NVA. We attacked them several times. And it takes, their communications are so poor that it takes them a while to get their shit together. But once they get it together, they're going to kill you. You know,
right.
And we ended up getting stuck on top of a mountain at the end of it. John Stone was killed. Three, I think, of the yards were killed, and a couple more were wounded. John was one of the Australians, so I took over his platoon for a little while, and then someone else came up and took it over after that. I think Harvey Brandy did. And I carried them. We started exfiltrating back down the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
We had guys on both sides of us, in front, behind us. We called in more airstrikes that day than had ever been called in on any one operation before.
Wow.
They were dropping stuff within very close on both sides of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the duty to carry me and my medics. Had the duty to carry John and these other guys that had been killed back down the mountain. And we got, at one time, we had some NVA come across in front of us and we actually eyeballed each other.
Mm.
But they knew that we weren't the big game, you know, that we weren't the the big gang, they could always come back and police us up later on. So they went ahead and got back in front of our guys. We called them more airstrikes on them. We got back down to the bottom of the hill, and the hill, it was a big mountain with triple canopy. But we got back down and set up a perimeter, and the Marines came in and picked us up then. And when they, on my chopper, I think they were CH-53s, on my chopper, the gunner was shot up all his machine gun ammunition. And then he had a grease gun. I don't know where the hell he got that.
Okay.
Probably from one of us, because we had grease guns.
Mm-hmm.
And the A camps used all obsolete weapons from the United States Army. They had the M1 Garand, M1 carbine, M2 carbine, mm-hmm. Thompson's grease guns, 30 cals. So they had all these guns. So I got to shoot all these old-timey World War II guns, which was fun.
Right.
But our A100, we got all our guys were equipped with M16s.
Okay.
But anyway, they shot he was shooting with this grease gun out the window and used up all his ammunition there. And then he grabbed one of my guys' M16s and was shooting with that. And, of course, we're sitting down in the middle where we can't even see out. You can hear the rounds hitting a chopper. You know, it's kind of like a 2x4 hitting a tin roof, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he grabbed one of the guy's guns and was shooting it, and it got shot out of his hand.
Wow.
Yeah, we were taking really, really heavy fire that day.
Was this the most intense fire you had seen up to this point?
Yeah, probably up to that point it was.
What size enemy force do you think you were facing there?
Well, I have heard any place between a reinforced company, which I'm not sure what that means, to a battalion.
Mm.
So I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And how many of your guys were there at this point?
Oh, it was the A100 company. Yeah. It's about 100 guys.
Okay. All right. How long did this operation last?
Well, the whole operation lasted about 20 days.
Yeah, 20 days, right.
Yeah, that's right. But this particular firefight started probably mid-morning and went on until late afternoon,
mm-hmm.
with intermittent fire the whole time.
Okay. What type of weaponry was the NVA using? Just the standard AKs and
probably AKs and SKSs.
Okay,
but mainly AKs. Yeah.
All right.
And whatever kind of machine gun they had, not sure what machine gun they had.
Okay.
They did have quite a number of machine guns. I mean, mm-hmm. they had more than two.
Right. All right. Well, were you, most of the time when you were with A100, was it nearly always facing NVA?
Yeah.
Okay, so, right. Was there a noticeable difference between them and the VC, or?
Well, there was a noticeable difference in the they had better weapons, they weren't any better in the field than we were.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the hardcore BC knew their territory like the back of their hand.
Right.
The NVA didn't know the territory any better than we did. I mean, they were walking on it for the first time, too, a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
Their camouflage wasn't near as good. Nothing they did was nearly as good as the hardcore BC. They were outstanding infantry
mm-hmm.
soldiers.
Okay. All right. One thing you mentioned a minute ago about the some of the like the A107 and the A104 carrying the obsolete weapons. Why was that?
Because they were free. I mean, you know, they were cheap. They were in the U.S. Army arsenal, and they gave them to the South Vietnamese.
Okay. What about the American troops there? What did?
No, we had M16s.
Okay. All right.
And we also had M79s, which wasn't a World War II item, but
did
you ever use M14s?
I qualified with them in training.
Right. Okay. Well, that brings up a question I wanted to ask you. What was your opinion of the M16? Because I know a lot of veterans have had problems with them.
I had one jam on me one time that was when we were up the valley in Trebong that I could not get it unjammed without taking it completely apart. And even then, I had a hard time getting the cartridge out of the barrel. I started using graphite rather than oil on my gun.
Okay.
And I never had any more problems with it after that.
Okay.
And that was on the shorty, actually it was an AR-15.
Okay.
Is what the guys at on A-100 had. A-100 was got a lot of little perks, like we got the M16 or the AR-15s rather than the M16s.
Mm-hmm.
We also were given Seiko watches. We were given Canon half frame 35 mil cameras, which is where all these pictures came from.
Right.
We were given LARP rations, which at that time nobody else got but us. Just a lot of little things like that we got that the normal ACAMs didn't get. And when we came back from, as a matter of fact, when we came back from Blackjack 12 and turned in our pictures, which are here, they said, well, we gave these cameras to you guys to take intelligence pictures, and you guys, all you took is a bunch of fucking tourist pictures. A bunch of guys of each other. You know?
Right. Right.
So they took the camera on the next operation. They took the cameras away from us, except for the team leader and the team sergeant. Even the XO didn't get a camera.
Okay.
He said, all you guys took was a bunch of fucking tourist pictures.
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, being a member of A-100, this elite of the elite, when you come in contact with, if you ever did, with regular troops or members of other A units, were you treated any differently? Did they...
We would probably had a little bit more respect from the regular A units. The Mike forces in general had more respect from the A, had a lot of respect from the A units because it was our job to come in and bail their ass out if they were in trouble.
Right.
I had no contact whatsoever with regular troops. I saw the Marines occasionally, when, you know, because we were out in Da Nang and stuff like that, and so were they, but really had no contact with them at all.
Okay. Well, speaking of these missions of bailing out the outposts and those who got in trouble, how often were you on those missions? How often did you?
Well, we went out 3 or 4 times while I was with, in the 5 months I was with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When Small got captured, Bert Small got captured, we went out that time, and we went out one other time back up the farm duck for some reason, and I don't really even remember why.
Okay. And you would be called out when these people were basically in dire straits? Or,
yeah.
Yeah. And were usually successful in the operations of rescue?
Now we didn't find Bird, or we didn't find any of the other guy that got killed that day. But normally we would go out and just reinforce a camp or something,
mm-hmm.
and then run operations out from the camp.
Mm-hmm.
But they really weren't our main focus. Our main focus was the MGF Blackjack operation.
Right. Right. Okay. Were you always on call though for these missions?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you're not on a mission, when you have a little downtime, how would you spend it?
I would run a sick call, check equipment, make sure we had big Connex containers. I had a multitude. I had a pharmacy that was bigger than most doctors have. I had penicillin, streptomycin, amphetamines. We use a lot of amphetamines when you get out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
Legally, I mean, not, this wasn't, you know, I saw very few drugs. I saw no drug use in Vietnam.
Okay.
With the guys I was with, there was a lot of drinking, but no drug use.
Right.
But I had this huge pharmacy mm-hmm. that I could treat people with, you know,
right.
and did.
Mm-hmm.
I had tetracycline, streptomycin, penicillin, both injectable and tablet form. You know what I mean? I could do almost anything I wanted.
Right.
You know. And then if I couldn't handle it, I had a doctor right up on the hill
mm-hmm.
that could.
Okay.
I see our at the ACAMS that we advised, if you got wounded, you went to a Vietnamese hospital. Not the American. One of the boys got hit, he went to a Vietnamese hospital. But the guys we commanded, they went and saw that they went to an American hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So they got really good treatment.
Okay. All right. Well, while you were with A100, did you continue with the MedCap missions there too?
No, there was no MedCap at all.
Okay.
We were strictly a battle group.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. Well, how would you, maybe repeating a little bit here, but how would you describe the relationship with the Montagnards? Did you feel pretty close to the Montagnards?
Yeah, I think, yeah.
Okay.
And they liked us. I mean, you know.
Right. Okay. Well, after Operation Oconee, is that how I pronounce it?
Oconee?
Was this right about the time when you decided to extend your tour?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. What made you decide to extend it?
I would probably, if the war was still going on and I hadn't gotten shot or hadn't gotten hit with shrapnel, I would still be there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I enjoyed doing what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little bit of the Wild West, and I mean, one of my brother and I's heroes were Billy the Kid and Jesse James and the Lincoln County War, and you know, so yeah, I was a cowboy and liked doing what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what did you have to do to extend it?
Just sign some paperwork.
Okay.
Plus, I could never come back to making the bed, shine and choose Army. I mean, it just.
Right. Yeah, sure. Were you able to remain with A100?
Yeah.
Okay. So no time away from them at all then?
No.
All right. Okay. Well, how many other missions did you participate in after this until you were wounded?
One
more. Okay, so you were wounded on the very next
right.
mission. Okay.
All right. The boys, we let the boys go home on leave for 2 weeks to the lot in Bobbitt.
Mm-hmm.
And so me and the other guys that were still in Da Nang just kind of cooled it
mm-hmm.
and had a good time, you know.
Right.
The bar was open every day, and
mm-hmm.
guys were coming in from the camps that we knew, and so there was new guys in there all the time, and we were friends with all of them, and a lot of them we had been in training with, and guys you might not see for 2 or 3 months, and then you'll, you know, spend a couple of days with them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how much time was there in between you re-upping and this operation?
Probably not more than a couple of weeks or a month.
Okay.
You know.
All right. Okay. Well, can you tell me then about this operation?
Okay, this was Blackjack, I believe it's 13.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew from Da Nang, Marble Mountain, to Quay Phu Bai.
Mm-hmm.
And we got in trucks at Fubai and were taken covered trucks where the people couldn't see inside it. And we were taken to west of Denang, or Hue, about 20 miles, about as far as I could go without getting into Indian territory.
Right.
And we spent the rest of the day there and then started infiltrating that night.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point during the infiltration, by this time I was a platoon sergeant. I wasn't just a straight medic again.
Mm-hmm.
And we ran into a booby trap that we set it off, and it killed two of the yards and wounded Jerry Knight, one of the American platoon leader I had.
Mm-hmm.
And it blew a hole in his back about like that.
Mm-hmm.
And but it really was just all flesh. I mean, didn't get any bone, didn't cripple him up or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But it did kill a couple of the yards.
Right.
And so we set up camp there that night. And then the next morning, we obviously couldn't go on with three wounded guys, you know, or the bodies of the yards. And Captain Bonnie Valana picked my platoon to take these guys back to the Marines wouldn't come in and get us because they considered it a hot LZ. And they wouldn't come in and pick up what they called Vietnamese, even though it was Americans involved in it.
Right.
They wouldn't come in and pick us up.
Mm-hmm.
So we started taking these guys back to a place where the trucks could come and pick them up again, or somebody could come and pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
And we were pretty sure we were going to get ambushed because they had been there the night before, obviously, and they were going to get us that day. But I had broken an ambush before, and I was pretty confident that I could do it, you know. And I had a new Australian guy with me, took Jerry's place, and we just got into a firefight, and it went on for about, I don't know, 10 minutes maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And I was turned shooting an M79, and something blew up behind me. And I don't know if it was a mine, a grenade, but anyway, it killed two more of the boys, and I was wounded.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I went down, the boys didn't know this new Australian and wouldn't take anything from him, wouldn't take any orders from him, so we had to retreat back to the night logger.
Mm-hmm.
And Keith Parker, the combo guy, finally snagged a Marine helicopter that would come in and pick us up.
Mm-hmm.
But he wouldn't pick up the yards, he'd only pick up the two Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So they medevaced us, and then from there I went to Chu. I was operated on at Fubai, had a colostomy for about 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Went to William Beaumont Army Hospital in El Paso and was there the rest of the time and got out of the Army then.
Okay.
Now, after I got hit, and after the yards, by this time the yards in a period of less than a year had been out on half a dozen really tough operations. The one where they almost starved to death, and then the rest of them with when I was with them. And the yards revolted.
Mm.
And refused to go any further.
Right.
And so they took all their guns away from them. And then they decided, well, this isn't a real smart fucking idea. We better give them back. So they give them all back, but they would not go on any further.
Right.
So they were pulled out and taken back home.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, what happened with A100 after you left? What do you know?
It was disbanded.
It was disbanded. Okay. All right. As far as you yourself, how long did it take you to recover from your wounds?
Well, it's kind of funny. As soon as I got into El Paso, I got a barium enema to see the track of this wound.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I went back, I also had a leg wound. And once that healed up, they put me on convalescent leave mm-hmm. for 30 days. Went back, did an x-ray, wound still open in my intestines.
Mm-hmm.
Send me back out on convalescent leave, go back, take another barium enema, still showing open.
Mm-hmm.
What had actually happened was the barium had gotten into the tract of the wound and had remained there even after it healed.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And so it showed open when it was actually closed. So I had a colostomy for 6 months when I should have had one for like 2 months.
Mm-hmm. Right, goodness.
And then after that, I got out.
Yeah. Well, had you wanted to get back in, or wanted to stay in the military though?
Yeah, at one time I did, but the more I thought about it, you know, once you slow down and you're back with regular people again, and your mom and dad and your girlfriend, and you think, do I really want to go back and do that again? You know? I mean, I looked through it once. Am I going to do it again? So I never went.
Okay. All right. So did you have any difficulty adjusting?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. All right. What about when you were finally on your feet again and out of the hospital and all? How were you treated as far as, you know, your home?
Very well. I mean, I was in Texas and New Mexico where, you know,
right,
there weren't any protests. I mean, mm-hmm. you know.
Okay.
And, but most people never even knew. I mean, you know, it was like, the one thing I can say is a lot of people, they say, hey, we haven't seen you around lately. Yeah, I've been gone for about a year.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, no.
Yes, sir.
So, I mean, you know, it's, and I'm sure that's what the guys get today, you know.
Mm-hmm. Did you keep up with the guys in your unit after you got back?
No, we didn't. And then, about 10 years ago, I didn't hear from anybody for 10 years, or for 20, over 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
About, well, I guess more like 15 years ago, we all started making contact again. We're all getting old enough to where we wanted to talk to each other again.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we're all in contact now.
Okay. But that time when you were back in Vietnam and you were wounded on the battlefield and taken away by a helicopter, did they know what your fate was? Did they know
No.
what had been? So it was not until years later that they knew what had happened to you then?
Right.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, one of the things you get from people that, like I got in contact with this girl a couple of years ago that I knew in high school. And she says, you know, I was at the wall and I looked for your name.
Hmm. Wow.
Which kind of bothers you, you know?
Sure. Yes, sir.
But no, they didn't know what had happened to me until we got in contact with each other again. And now we're all big buddies again. We go to, you know, I've been to Australia several times.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we're all good friends now.
Mm-hmm.
Just like we always were. As a matter of fact, we talked about it one time about how good of friends we were.
Mm-hmm.
Only being together 6 months.
Yes, sir.
And it finally dawned on one. Somebody said, well, yeah, we all took the same test. We're all the same person. You know, they're very similar.
Right. Well, how difficult was it that, you know, that separation there for, and not knowing what happened? Because I've heard other veterans say when I've interviewed them that when a friend or someone would get wounded, they're off on the helicopter and they're gone and you know nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, How difficult was that? I mean, just that separation and not knowing about your friends and what had happened with them.
Well, now I somebody wrote me a letter telling me what had happened with the guys about the revolt and stuff. And most of us were getting pretty short at that time, and I knew they were all coming back. So I was pretty sure they all came back. Mm-hmm. The only one I didn't know about was World Two guys, John Early, and whom I spoke with you earlier about, and Harvey Brandy. And they went A113, which was a light force unit.
Okay.
And they went into Long Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And John was wounded very badly there, and Harvey was taken prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
And walked from Long Bay, which is just, where Long Bay is, by caisson.
Right. Yes,
he walked from Long Bay to Hanoi, get the shit beat out of him all the time.
Wow.
Wounded.
Right.
He had been wounded. He and another guy. And I tell you a funny story about Harvey. Mm. He, just in his cell, the door was just had wood slats in it. He could look out and he could see the Vietnamese hung their guns right outside his door, and he couldn't reach them, but he could see them.
Mm-hmm.
So he memorized the serial number on one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he was being interrogated, and they were talking to him about the difference between the AK and the M16. He said, "Oh, the M16 is so much better. It's superior in every way." And they said, "Well, how do you know?" And he said, "You've never shot an AK-47. He said, "Oh, yeah, I have." He says, "Your guard lets me shoot this one." and read off the number.
Right.
And his guard disappeared.
Oh, boy.
As a matter of fact, there's a book about POWs. It's about this thing. I don't remember the name of it, but Harvey is listed in there as one of the most heroic POWs.
Mm.
And unfortunately, Harvey's an alcoholic, and I understand he's pretty good until about noon, but from noon to 8 o'clock, he starts going readily downhill. But he was a really good field soldier, but he wasn't worth a shit once he got into Da Nang either.
Mm.
Another funny story, Ben Long, the medic that was with me the day I got hit, he and I were coming back from mooring around in Da Nang one night. We were driving an old ambulance, and there was a Jeep parked alongside the road that the transmission had locked up on.
Mm-hmm.
And it had Lieutenant Johnny Reb painted on the windscreen. So we hopped out, and I got in it, and Ben pushed me back. I held in the clutch, and Ben pushed me back to our camp. And we had Filipino mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
So I turned it over to them, and I said, put our numbers on, paint it, repaint it, and put our numbers on it, A100 and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So from then on, Ben Long and I, two buck sergeants, had our own Jeep. And people would come in and say, "Oh, hey, Chrissy, can I borrow your Jeep?" "Sure." So anyway, after I got hit, some captain tried to take it away from Ben. And this lieutenant colonel that was in charge of I Corps, I can't think what his name is, he told his captain, he says, "Hey, now those boys stole that Jeep fair and square, and that's his Jeep. It's not yours, and you're not to take it away from him."
Right.
So it was pretty cool.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, are there, now that we're on these stories like this, are there any more that stick out in your mind that you can...
Oh, I'm sure there are, but I can't think of them right off the top of my
head.
Sure. But we've all gotten back together, and we're all very good friends. They have all done well.
Mm-hmm.
Captain Bob Valana, was a great officer. He went on to go to work for the FBI and was instrumental in capturing or getting a conviction on John Gotti. He was in charge of the criminal division of New York City for the FBI.
Okay.
Lewis, who was the XO, went into the CIA. He could pick up a language just like that. And I'm sure he's someplace still deep in the CIA, probably retired by now. Bob Price, the team sergeant, passed away not long ago. He retired from the Army after 30 years. Ben Long went on to become command sergeant major of the Oregon National Guard. Keith Parker, who snagged the helicopter that saved my ass, has his own biological company and works for Exxon, did a lot of work on the Exxon Valdez incident, and he works all over the world now for Exxon. Jerry Knight retired from the military and went to work for the Saudi royal family and finally retired from them not long ago. And I myself was there on, so let's see. Two of the Aussies got killed. One of the, Tony Singer got killed shortly after I left. Barry Rust stayed in the military. He was a warrant officer, which is, their warrant officers are our first sergeants. And he went on to become a major in the Australian Army and worked out of Papua New Guinea for a long time. And then ended up with the Melbourne school system until he retired. Bruce Prosper went back with the Australian Regiment and spent another year there and then retired from the military as a command sergeant major, what we call a command sergeant. I'm not sure what they call it.
Okay.
So all of us have done reasonably well. I can't think of anybody else. Brady's the only one that's really got a problem.
Okay. Let's see. Yeah, I definitely want to take a look at these, but as far as, let's see, I'd like to ask you a few more questions here, but did you follow, after following your wounding and getting back to the States, did you follow the war fairly closely?
Or? Yeah. Okay. Yes.
All right. And how did you feel on April 30th, 1975, when Saigon fell? What was your thoughts?
That we sold them out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Really sold out the mountain yards.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever think about and wonder what happened to your mountain yard friends? Do you have any, do you know anything about what happened to them?
No.
Okay. All right. Let's talk a little bit about, if you don't mind, about life after the Army. When you made your decision to leave the Army, what happened next? What did you do once you were out?
Oh, smoked a lot of dope, spent all the money I'd saved.
Mm-hmm.
Me and a girl in Albuquerque. And I finally woke up one day and said, this has got to stop, and left Albuquerque and went to Oklahoma City.
Mm-hmm.
Started flying airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up as an aircraft salesman for quite a few years at Catlin Aviation in Oklahoma City.
Okay.
Made a good living doing it.
Mm-hmm.
When the first oil crash, after that, I... general aviation was kind of dying off, and I knew I had ridden on Southwest a couple of times, and they were coming to, and this was in Oklahoma City.
Okay.
They were coming to Oklahoma City, and I had gotten married to a really great little lady that I'm still married to for 38 years.
Okay.
And when Southwest was coming to Oklahoma City, I decided to, you know, just try to get a job with them, and it's turned out to be a great deal, you know.
Okay.
I live in a little town called Maypearl. We own a house that's over 100 years old, and we've completely restored it. Mm-hmm. No kids.
Right. All right. Well, you mentioned flying. When did you learn to fly?
I had learned to fly. I got my private license in high school. Mm-hmm. My brother and I were the proverbial airport kids, and that's why I was wanting to go to helicopter school.
Okay.
But we were the proverbial airport kids, and we hung around the airport and did odd jobs and gassed airplanes and washed them and bummed rides and played. And so I've always been involved in aviation, and it just went from there. So,
right.
But I got my commercial multi-engine and instrument on the GI Bill.
Okay. All right. Do you ever fly anymore?
No, I haven't flown in over 30 years now.
Okay.
Well, 20 years.
All right. Okay. Well, looking back on your Vietnam experience and your time over there, what's your opinion of your time there, looking back on it?
Oh, it was good.
Mm-hmm.
I learned patience. I learned how to, living out on an A camp, I learned what discrimination is. Because when you're living out on the A camp and there's 12 round eyes, mm-hmm. Actually there's never 12 out there, but there's more like 8 to 10.
Okay.
With 300 Vietnamese mountain yards and stuff. You learn what it's like to be in the minority.
Right.
Even though you're a powerful minority, you're still a minority.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned a lot about patience.
Mm-hmm.
In dealing with people. Because when you deal with the Vietnamese, you're dealing with a society that's totally different than your own.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the mountain yards.
Well, what was at the time? Looking back now, what's your opinion of U.S. foreign policy in Vietnam and participation in the war? What do you think it was the right thing to do, or what? How do you look at it?
No, it probably. Well, yeah, it was the right thing. In my opinion, the Vietnam War was never about Vietnam, not to begin with. I mean, we started out supporting the French. And the only reason we were supporting them is because of the Chinese communists, and France was about to fall to the communists at the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't want Western Europe going communist.
Right.
So we originally started supporting the French, not because of Vietnam, but because of France itself,
mm-hmm.
and trying to keep it from failing. Which we did.
Right.
So we were very successful in that. But we just hung in with Vietnam too long. It was probably a war we shouldn't have gotten involved in, except we were wanting to stop the communists every place, you know, mm-hmm. or at least confront them.
Right.
And we really did end up winning.
Well, what do you think about U.S.-Vietnamese relations today and this close relationship we're developing with them? What do you think about that?
I don't care.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Looking back on your experience again, how would you say that Vietnam affected you the most? Or would you
how did it? Well, I don't know. Like I said, I learned patience.
Mm-hmm.
I've got an infinite amount of patience. I look back on it, overall, it's a positive experience, you know.
Okay. All right. Well,
plus I got to do a lot of things that I was a doctor. You know, I got to do things as a medic that nobody gets to do.
Mm-hmm. Sorry. All right. Is there anything about your Vietnam experience that you would change if you could?
Yeah, I wouldn't get shot.
Sure. Yes, sir.
Beyond that, no.
Okay. All right. Well,
we're about at the end here, so is there anything else you want to say about your experiences before we wrap things up?
No, not really. I think you pretty well covered everything, and what you haven't covered, I've given you paperwork on and stuff. So.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming in. And
well, thank you.
For participating. And I'll go ahead and stop the interview, but I would like to take a look at these pictures, if you could go over them with me.